Today's program has been brought to you by Underground Meats, an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. For more information, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. Good evening and welcome to For Men About It.
On HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-host for this show on all things fermentable.
That's right. And we're going to dive in pretty quickly into this. We have one announcement, and that is Choctoberfest. We have a competition that we're holding here in New York City in partner with Divine Chocolate and Jimmy's Number 43. Basically, it's ferment some chocolate, something with chocolate in it, and we will have different prizes. To register, go to fermentaboutit.com and find a website.
Yep. It's not up there yet, but it'll be up there tonight. That's going to be the first thing that we do when we get after the show. The details are we'll have the competition will actually be held on Saturday, October 26th at Jimmy's Number 43 in the East Village from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. As Chris mentioned, you can enter anything fermentable, be it beer or coke or cider or some kind of fermented food, chocolate soda, whatever, anything. We're going to have two categories, an alcoholic, which is over 1.5% ABV, or non-alcoholic, which is under 1.5 ABV. As we said, it can be food or beverage. We're going to have a first place and a second place prize in each category. It's $150 for first place winners and $50 for second place. And we'll also have a people's choice, which is $100. So as we said, we're going to post all the information on our website. You guys can sign up there. And then we're also going to be selling tickets. So if you choose not to ferment something, but you'd like to come and sample all this cocoa goodness, you'll be able to do that as well.
That's right. And so, we're very excited about it.
Yeah.
It's in honor of Fair Trade Month, and Divine Chocolate is a fair trade company that we support and love.
Oh, and the one thing that whatever you do, it just has to be fermented with some kind of chocolate or cocoa powder or cocoa nibs or something chocolatey.
And if you're in the area, we will invite you to a cocoa fermented show, and we'll talk about what you did if you are a winner.
Yep. So, Chris, who do we have on today?
I'm very excited about today. One of the things I love about this show is learning about all these new things. I am fairly new to anything fermented other than beer, for the most part. Today is all about soy. And on the phone, we have Christian Elwell from South River Miso.
Hi, Christian.
Hello, Mary.
How are you?
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So what is miso?
Miso, it's a delicious all-purpose and very high-quality protein seasoning that originated in Japan. It first showed up in the Japanese script about 800 AD. So it's a very ancient food. And we have been making it here since 1981, and it's known primarily as a seasoning used in soup for flavoring soup. But it's in Japan, it was used in many different dishes and in all aspects of the Japanese cuisine. But for the last 30 years, it's been making its way into the natural foods world in the United States and in the West, and it's used in many places where you would ordinarily use salt, but because miso is a savory, salty seasoning, but it's made through a double fermentation process.
What does
not
that
just
mean?
Soy, but with soy and grain.
What does it mean to be double fermented?
Yeah, by double fermentation, I mean, well, in the actual process of making miso, the first step is growing a culture on the grain. Usually rice or barley were the main grains that were used traditionally, but one could use any grain. And the rice or the grain is first steamed, And then a culture is grown on it by using the spores of the Aspergillus mold. And in the old, in more ancient times, the grain was just left out under, in the open air or in the on the floor of the miso shops, and the wild Aspergillus spores would land on it, and that would be the start of the fermentation. Nowadays, there are specialized strains of the Aspergillus mold that one can purchase for different types of miso or different grains that are used in the fermentation. But the grain is steamed and then inoculated with the spores of the mold, and then over about a 30 to 45 hour period, depending on the grain, the mold metabolizes on the grain. It has to be kept in a incubating environment of about 90 degrees and high humidity. And during that time, the mold grows on the grain, changes the starches into sugars, and creates an abundance of digestive enzymes. And that's what is captured in the miso making. At that point, the cultured grain, which in Japanese is called koji, K-O-J-I, mm-hmm. It's salted to preserve the nutrition and to preserve the enzymes that have been created. So that's the first step in the miso-making process. The koji is used for a number of other fermented foods, by the way. Instead of salting it, the koji is used fresh, or dried koji is used for making sake, the rice wine, or amasake, a sweet pudding, or mirin, another Japanese seasoning, or rice vinegar. All those foods are started with koji, the cultured grain, as the mother starter of the fermentation. In the case of miso, the cultured grain or koji is salted, and then it is mixed together with cooked beans, and that could be beans of any variety, but traditionally it was the soybean that was used. And then also added to that mixture is some already mature miso from the same variety, and that so the new miso is inoculated with some already mature miso, much like a sourdough starter.
Uh-huh.
And then that mixture is put into a fermentation vat, and there begins the second part of the fermentation, which can last anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 years, depending on the variety of miso and the salt content.
Oh, wow. It does.
So it's a pretty, most of the traditional misos are quite lengthy fermentations. A lot of the miso that we make here are three-year fermentations, but they're also a three-month fermentation. We do have one variety that's a three-week fermentation.
Is there a preferred quality difference with the longer fermentation?
The longer fermentations are made with a higher percentage of salt, and also in the recipe they have a higher percentage of beans in the formula, and so the taste is a much heartier taste. It's almost meat-like in its flavor, especially when you're using the soybean. So it's much higher in protein content than, for instance, the lighter miso, shorter fermentations, which have less salt and more grain in the formula.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a very interesting food. It's a and it's been around a long time, and it has immense health benefits in that it's loaded with microorganisms and enzymes that help and aid in digestion of whatever we eat, and also ward off harmful organisms. So it's very good for building a healthy immune system.
That's right. You've been at it since 81, you said?
Yes.
What got you into it, personally?
Yeah, I kind of approach miso making from a life experience where in when I was in my mid-20s, and I was serving at that time in Iran in the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
My father died of cancer, pancreatic cancer, at the age of 51, and it threw a loop into my whole orientation to life, and that I began to really wonder, you know, why are we here? What are we doing? And is there a way of life that could prevent degenerative illness and the kind of suffering that my father and so many of us now are having to deal with through the degeneration of our food supply and environmental issues and so forth. So it was through that experience and a lot of soul searching and seeking, I eventually came in touch with the macrobiotic teaching that came out of Japan, which is a traditional wisdom teaching about the relationship of food to health and where food was regarded as the best medicine. And miso in that world was highly regarded as one of the best medicines in terms of preventive medicine for when used on a regular basis to build a strong and healthy immune system and to ward off illness and live a happy life. That was the orientation I came to miso making with. And in those days, in the 1970s, there was no miso being made in the United States, and there was no organic miso available at that time.
You guys are one of the first, then, for sure.
Yeah, actually, our company, South River Miso, started in Ohio as the Ohio Miso Company in 1979, and it was the first organic miso made in the United States. Actually, I made a misstatement a minute ago. There was a miso company in the United States in Los Angeles, but it was more of a mass market kind of food, and it was not an organic miso, and it was the motive behind the miso is very different.
And they were likely not doing 3-year fermentations, right?
That's right. Yeah, and that's in the macrobiotic cosmology, the longer fermentations are also considered to be perhaps better misos to use for when it comes to healing diets, mm-hmm. so forth. The salt issue is a big question, because when we use, as we have, in our culture, people tend to use salt, just pure table salt. But in other cultures, and especially in Japan, salt is taken in the form of fermented foods. So it's not, people rarely eat pure salt, but they take their salt in combination with pickles or through miso or soy sauce or those kinds of foods, in which the salt is more balanced with the minerals and the oils of the foods through the fermentation process, and the it's less harsh on the system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where do you guys sell your miso?
Well, we have distributors on the Northeast and in some other parts of the country, and we sell it also directly through our website.
Which is southrivermiso.com.
Southrivermiso.com. That's a very informative website. There's lots of recipes there and pictures showing how miso is made and of our place there. To tell you the truth, right at the moment, I'm not sure which stores in Brooklyn, for instance, are selling miso. My son lives in Brooklyn. And I was going to call him just before the show, but I couldn't get through to ask him what what I should tell people if they want go out and get some. But they can certainly get it directly from us on the website.
Great.
Fantastic. It's a great website. It is a very fun website, very informative with how to use miso and the ingredients and what it is.
Yep. I'd also mentioned, actually, the New York Times on the well blogs, newyorktimes.com, they did an article on cooking with miso, and there are several really good recipes online. So that kind of was a nice coincidence that they ran that just at the time we're doing the show. So if people want some more inspiration, besides the recipes on your site, definitely check out this well blogs, nytimes.com. We're going to put all the links on our website tonight when we update our blog. So we'll definitely have a link to South River Miso as well as a link to some recipes.
Christian, thank you so much for your time and joining us today.
Well, you're welcome. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Okay,
cheers.
Take care.
We'll be back in a moment with Barry Schwartz from Barry's Tempeh.
Underground Meats is an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. They use small farms from southwest Wisconsin to source their meat. The animals are raised on pasture for their entire lives by farmers who care about animal welfare. While Underground Meats uses European traditions, they also use ingredients from the upper Midwest to try to create new types of salamis, experimenting with both ingredients and techniques. The salamis are made using heritage breeds, mostly red wattles, tamworths, berkshires, and mule foots. Try their award-winning cured pork shoulder and goat salami. To learn more and purchase products, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Welcome back to Ferment About It on heritageradionetwork.org. So now, tonight's program is all about fermenting soy. We just spoke to Christian Elwell from South River Miso, and we are in the studio now with Barry Schwartz from Barry's Tempeh. So Chris and I live in Williamsburg, and a few weeks ago I was wandering around the Smorgasburg Market, which is on North 7th? Right on the water, and Barry's Tempeh has a stand at at Smorgasburg, and I had his tempeh and was absolutely delicious. So that's kind of where the inspiration for doing this fermented soy is. So you're there every Saturday, correct?
Every Saturday, yeah.
So tell us about, what is tempeh, first of all?
Tempeh is a staple food from Indonesia. It's something that they eat every day. It's traditionally made of soybeans, and they grow soybeans in Indonesia, and it takes 24 hours for tempeh to be made, from cooking the soy to becoming tempeh. And it's something I've been playing around with for about 5 years, and we've been making commercially for about 3. And it's a lot of fun. And we found that tempeh, you can make tempeh out of any bean or grain. So it's not just soy.
Uh-huh.
Traditionally, it's soy. And I actually brought some with me today. I brought some azuki bean tempeh.
Ooh.
Azuki bean and brown rice.
Oh, awesome.
And you guys are welcome to taste it, and you can make some noise over the radio.
I'm going in.
Because I know you sell it at Smorgasburg.
We sell frozen pounds.
Mm-hmm. And then you also cook with it. Because I had the mix, I think it was a mixed tempeh with your peanut sauce on a bed of mixed greens.
Right.
It was absolutely amazing.
Well, part of that amazing is that some of the sauces that we make, and you guys should try these.
I tried this sauce at the Smorgasburg as well. Yeah. Really, really awesome. So what's in this sauce?
This is a peanut sauce.
So that's the adzuki?
That's adzuki bean.
Oh, yeah, it's delicious.
Yeah. So it really makes a difference. I mean, tempeh is tempeh, but mm-hmm. the different beans make them taste a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it takes 24 hours. So I was telling you guys earlier, you know, we have a crew that comes into the kitchen, and it's really fascinating, you know, to be part of the production process. We invite people come in to work with us, and we share that excitement. It takes 24 hours, so in 24 hours it goes from being cooked beans to this beautiful, like, solid cake of tempeh.
Yeah, what is the process?
It starts with grinding the beans and letting them sit for 12 hours in water. and that starts the fermentation. And
when they sit, does it sit at a certain temperature in that water?
No, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Okay.
It's just soaking. It's actually, it's changing the bean. The bean is like, the carbs are changing. When beans sit in water, the beans start changing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So after sitting for 12 hours in 5 gallon buckets, we make about, in a session at the kitchen, we make about 600 pounds of tempeh, which is a lot of tempeh. It's a lot of handwork.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing's like really mechanized. It's all like the Fred Flintstone tempeh.
Right.
Awesome.
So we take the beans and we cook them in a big vat. We cook about 70 pounds at a time. And from there, it gets spun dry. We have a giant centrifuge that spins the water off. At home, I would use a hair dryer, you know, but I wouldn't do it with 70 pounds.
Right.
I do it with, you know, with five.
Right.
And after that, they get inoculated with a culture called Rhizopus oligosporus, and that's the only cultured food, fermented food that comes from Indonesia. It's part of the Indonesian culture. So it gets, and then it gets bagged in bags that have holes in them so that the culture can breathe. And then we have to put them in a room that recreates the temperature, the climate of Indonesia, which is 87 degrees for 24 hours. And after about 12 hours, the culture like kind of takes off and it starts creating heat. And It's okay for it to be between 87 and 93 degrees, but given the opportunity, it'll go up to 120 degrees.
Wow.
And kill itself.
Just by the heat. From the activity.
It'll just keep heating and heating. And when we first went in to make the tempeh, we only came out with 45 pounds at a time. And they were dying. And we couldn't figure it out. We knew that it had to be 87 degrees, but we couldn't figure out why they were dying. And we figured out that you can only leave them in the incubator for 12 hours, take them out and cool them down so that the temperature, they didn't overheat.
Mm-hmm.
So we have them on big trays, on racks, and I'm pushing them the next day from room to room, trying to make sure that, you know, they're staying cool, that they're not overheating, or that they're not getting too cool.
And tempeh is different from, like, tofu, for instance, and other fermented soys, in that it still has a whole bean, so it has a lot of fiber in it, and it also has a lot of nutrients as well, correct?
Right. Tofu is coagulated soy milk, so it's a much more processed food than tempeh is.
Mm-hmm.
Tempeh is... The process of making tempeh makes... Beans are very hard to digest, so it's breaking down it's pre-digesting the beans so that you can get the nutrients from the bean.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it easier to digest.
And then they also have a lot of fiber too, which is
fiber,
not found in tofu
right.
and some of the other.
And it's really fulfilling. It's meaty. It's different than tofu. It gives you a different feel than tofu. It fills you up in a different way.
I agree.
It kind of fulfills that meat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the difference between our tempeh and the tempeh that you would like normally find in the refrigerated section, we sell ours frozen. Because it's fermented and the companies that sell it in the refrigerator pasteurize the tempeh.
Ah.
So they're stopping the fermentation by pasteurizing. We don't do that. We freeze it so that we're just halting it. We're not killing, you know, the goodness of the tempeh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeast is going to sleep.
Right, basically. Right, yeah. Right. So it's much healthier. You're getting the probiotics that you wouldn't be getting from commercial tempeh.
Mm-hmm.
You have how many different tempehs you have?
I brought one with me here, okay. But we make soy. We make soy, oats, and barley. We make buckwheat, quinoa, and brown rice. We make white bean and brown rice, and we make azuki bean and brown rice.
That's very fun. Is there a difference in time that it takes if you use different percentages of grains and beans?
It's pretty much all the same. And the reason that I mix the grains with the beans is because it makes it a complete protein.
Mm-hmm.
Like every bean or grain is missing an amino acid, and it's not missing an amino acid. It actually has a weak amino acid in the chain,
mm-hmm.
and so the grains complement the beans to make it complete.
Mm-hmm.
It's very fun. It's delicious, delicious tempeh.
Yeah, and one of the things I love to do is teach people how to make tempeh because it's pretty simple to do.
Do you give classes?
Yeah,
workshops?
I do. I give workshops. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's really fun, and you can easily do it at home. I even This is the inoculant. This is the Rhizopus oligosporus. This is 4 grams of Rhizopus oligosporus. And that will inoculate 40 pounds of tempeh.
Wow.
So he's holding up a plastic bag that looks like a pack of dry yeast, or like black sea salt is kind of like what it looks
powdered.
Like.
Yeah.
Powdered, yeah.
Yeah, it does look like. Kind of like herbs, like a finely crushed herb, dried herb.
Right.
So it's kind of what it looks like.
And there's only 2 places in the world that sell commercial tempeh culture that sells Rhizopus oligosporus. One is in Norway, I think. And the other one's in Tennessee.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What is the name of the one that's in Tennessee?
It's The Farm.
The Farm, okay.
They're the original tempeh makers, like in this country. And they've been doing it forever. And they're at a point where they can't even take any more customers.
Oh, wow.
They can't make enough.
There was a recent article the other day about a guy who had too much Saccharomyces cerevisiae in his gut. And so they call it auto-brewery syndrome. And where he was eating a lot of grain, and he was actually showing up drunk because his body was basically a brewery. He was fermenting his body.
That. Perfect.
I wonder if that could happen with tempeh. Yeah.
I wonder if it's contagious.
I want to hang out with that guy. I'm going to go kiss him.
And another great thing about tempeh is it's extremely versatile as far as cooking with it and flavors and
everything. Yeah.
So what are some of your favorite? I mean, obviously this peanut sauce is absolutely amazing. That's what I had at Smorgasburg.
Right. Well, traditionally it's fried.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't love fried foods. I mean, they do love fried foods.
Right.
Anything fried tastes amazing.
Yes.
But I'm trying to teach people how to cook it without frying it. And my favorite way of cooking it now is braising it. So you can marinate it for a while, and then you could sit it in a braise and let it slow cook, and that's the most delicious way to eat it.
So it won't fall apart if you marinate it too much?
No, it doesn't fall apart. It's pretty,
like
it's pretty tough.
Like a steak looking.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I can't say that I've ever cooked tempeh.
Yeah.
I fry everything, I admit.
Well, it's just amazing how many people that don't know what tempeh is. Like, people know what miso is, people know what tofu is, but tempeh is just, like, off the radar.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't exist for a lot of people. And the tempeh that people buy commercially in the refrigerator isn't that good. So we have to actually overcome people's, like, fear of tempeh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just don't like tempeh. And once they taste ours, they know it's good.
How far reaching is Barry's tempeh?
It's pretty much only in New York, like New York and Brooklyn. We don't make enough.
Right.
You know, we at this point we really, and we're working in a commercial in a shared kitchen.
Right.
And we're producing only 2 days a month.
Okay. But this is all you do though, right? Barry's tempeh right now?
Yeah, this is it.
But before this, you did a lot of other stuff. We were talking before this.
I've been around the world. Yeah. I was a paramedic for a bit. I was a nurse in a socialist youth movement camp.
Oh, wow.
For a year. And I was the chef in a yoga ashram.
Oh, wow.
And that's pretty much what taught me how to make tempeh.
From the yoga ashram.
Yeah, I had time on my hands, and I like to play. And tempeh's playing. You know, that's what it is to me. It's the culture. You just have to set up like an environment that it likes, like all ferments.
Right.
And it just takes on. You just have to know what the culture likes.
Right.
And this culture likes 87 degrees and humid.
And as a home brewer, or as a home tempeh maker, did you have to monitor, you had to monitor that. Was it as challenging for the rising and falling of the temperatures? Like in the commercial facility, that's when they started going to 120 degrees. But as a home brewery, were you having that same sort of mishap? And do you think that was from volume being?
You know, like making anything, it's all about observation. Mm-hmm. Like you just have to watch and adjust and adjust and adjust. And the tempeh gets better and better. At home, it was easier. It was only, I'd only be making 10 pounds at a time. You know, in the kitchen, the problem with production with making 600 pounds is, like when they're on racks, every stage of the rack is a different temperature,
right.
And the inner tempeh is warmer than the outer tempeh. Yeah. So during the day, I might have to move them around. I might have to revolve them.
Right.
So it's work for me.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to us about tempeh. And I would encourage everybody, if you haven't been to the Smorgasburg, it's in Williamsburg every Saturday. You can go and taste some of Barry's tempeh and buy some to take home and cook with. So we'll put a link to your website as well as a link to some recipes.
Is there a word?
Oh, there is a word.
Yeah, there's a word. Secret Barry's word. Secret tempeh word.
I better get it out, too, because I don't even know what it is. Just a second. This is a word that you can say to us at Smorgasburg to get a discount on a meal, dollar discount.
And it's worth it. It's delicious, delicious tempeh. Yeah. And
I highly recommend the kind with the peanut, the dish that whatever dish that he's doing that has peanut sauce, that's the one.
Well, here we go. I'm probably really bastardizing the way it's pronounced, but the word is nuchi goosey.
Nuchi goosey.
And it's a Japanese word, and it means food is the medicine of life.
Nice.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah.
Nuchi goosey.
Remember that and bring it with you to Smorgasburg when you're there, and we'll give you a dollar discount off a meal.
Awesome. So next week, I will be gone. I unfortunately am going to be out of town for a work meeting, but Chris will be in the studio.
That's right.
With a couple of homebrewers from the New York City homebrewers that brewed a pumpkin saison at 508. And
I'm going to be on the phone with Dick Cantwell of Elysian Brewing Company to talk all things pumpkin. There are a few people that know more about brewing with pumpkin than this man. And I'm very, 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 I'm kind of really ecstatic about this. A big fan of what he does.
It's going to be a great show. So I'm sorry I can't be here, but I think it's going to be great. Dick Cantwell is a super nice guy, and it'll be fun. You guys will have fun.
If you're in New York, sign up to join us for Choctoberfest at FermentAboutIt.com. We will talk to you next week on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Ferment About It.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.